of uniformed police, although these could have been available to us in adequate numbers and within minutes had our own campus assessment of the situation indicated that need. Generally, when it has been suggested that riots and disturbances at many colleges and universities actually are part of an international conspiracy or nationwide plot, liberal observers suggest that this could not be true. Those who oppose the conspiracy theory claim that each case was an isolated situation brought on by some specific grievance of a group of students, with a confrontation poorly handled by an administrator who lost his cool and called the cops. On the other hand, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover feels differently. In August, he reported on workshops conducted as part of the National Convention of the Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, held at Michigan State University in June. The workshops dealt with the use of sabotage and explosives. The participating students representing chapters on college and university campuses across the land discussed various devices which might be developed for use in planned attacks on selective service facilities. They explored the use of combustible materials and various types of bombs which could be devised to destroy communications and plumbing systems of strategic buildings. They even discussed the firing of Molotov cocktails from shotguns. In fact, I noted in the news just the other day that some postgraduate student had arrived back on Berkeley after this short course and proceeded to wreck the ROTC armory. Director Hoover said much of the unrest and violence on campuses was instigated and precipitated by a subversive force, which is growing in numbers and militancy. It is called the New Left, and its core is the organization known as SDS, end quote. Now, that's what the FBI believes, but that's an arm of the establishment. Could it be they are guilty of waving the red flag in order to stir up a greater unification of resistance? Perhaps, but let's go to the original source and find out what Carl Davidson, National Secretary for SDS, has written about his organization's new strategy and tactics for the future, which they intend to use on every college campus in the country. Speaking of anti-recruiter sit-ins, Davidson states, "The purpose is disruption and obstruction of certain events and actions by whatever means necessary." Speaking of the criticism against SDS that their actions against Dow Chemical denied others the right of free speech and assembly, Davidson states simply, and I quote, "In a sense, this is true. Since they are without legitimacy in our eyes, they are without rights. Our second answer rests in a revolutionary critique of the institutions and society we are trying to destroy. Our critique argues that the social order we are rebelling against is totalitarian, manipulative, repressive, and anti-democratic, and to operate within the realms of bourgeoisie's civil liberties is to remain enslaved, since the legal apparatus is designed to sustain the dominant order. It is the duty of a revolutionary not only to be intolerant of, but to actually suppress the anti-democratic activities of the dominant order," end quote. And that's from the record of the SDS spokesman. On the less violent side is another student organization, the National Student Association. NSA's constant public criticism of draft policies and its legal suit against Selective Service Director Lewis B. Hershey brought support to the organization from anti-Vietnam students in every state. A total of 368 college and university student bodies vote and pay dues to this organization. This year, the organization has $800,000 in its budget from dues and from fees from student travel and insurance, sale of books and publications. NSA's headquarters offers quick access to the information on organizational techniques, legal rights of students, and details of protest campaigns at other colleges. They offer telephone advice to protesters while the demonstrations are in progress in some instances. In others, they send representatives. NSA's efforts to produce change in the classroom has brought it a three-year, $315,000 grant from a private foundation to coordinate and assist student-initiated educational reform movements. The grant, says Edward Schwartz, 25-year-old retiring president, will enable NSA to, quote, "generate quiet revolutions instead of ugly ones," end quote, on college campuses. So much for two national student organizations which appear to have similar goals, but will use different methods to achieve these goals. There are many other student and partially student activist or civil right organizations that have appeared on college campuses across the nation in the last 8 years. Black Power student groups, who now confuse the issue by a demand for resegregation, are among the more militant of student groups, that is, the Black Student Union and Black Panthers. It is true that only an estimated 2 to 10% of the student population has in the past 4 years taken any active part in campus demonstrations. It is also true that an even smaller percentage of the student population seriously intends to mount actions in an attempt to overthrow either the university or the society which supports it. But there are indications that the fraction may be growing, and if the new strategy of the new left is effective, new recruits will join the ranks by the hundreds and maybe the thousands during the fall of 1968. The strategy is simple, as outlined by the leaders. At each campus, you make demands which the particular college or university cannot accept. When the demands are not met in full, a small number of activist students will seize a building and scream loudly for amnesty from any punishment which might result from their acts. So far, in the final week of the spring semester, students responding to the SDS call for a national strike against the Vietnam War hit 25 American universities with uprisings that varied from five-hour sit-ins to riots that paralyzed Columbia University and led recently to the resignation of President Grayson Kirk. What the activist students want after they seize a building is a confrontation with authority, hopefully police in uniform. It has been said that fire hoses turned on student demonstrators at the San Francisco City Hall in 1960 made more converts to revolution than the combined works of Marx and Mao. The student rebels of the spring of 1968 have had a summer to think about what they're going to protest this year. Steve Halliwell, a leader of radical students during the Columbia Revolt, was interviewed in mid-August by UPI writers who reported, "I'm against meaningless work, sexual repression, forced consumption, racial oppression, and irrelevant education." The UPI report tried to pin down the nature of the student revolts in the United States, Latin America, Europe, and Asia. Two basic elements of the student revolt emerged, said the report. The first is that students everywhere feel that established institutions have been sluggish in adapting to modern conditions. They want a sharp acceleration in the pace of change. The second concerns the way in which they would like to see change take place. They're opposed to reforms that come down from above. The students' attitude has been summed up by Diana Hagos, 22, of Connecticut, who said, "If we had to narrow everything down to one principle, it would be this. Decisions should be made by the people they affect." Students everywhere complain that they have little control over the universities they attend. Radicals and moderates alike, said the UPI report, were nearly unanimous in scores of interviews around the world that basic decisions about the universities, the courses to be taught, and the ways in which the institutions are to expand ought to be made democratically. The average reaction by college administrators, even college faculty, and many outside the academic community is a firm, if they don't like it, they're free to leave. And that last statement leads us directly into the concept of reaction. There are three likely reactions to student discontent. It can be ignored, it can be suppressed, or it can be reconciled. To many observers, the method of handling the situation, which seems to be gaining popularity, is suppression. While it is politically appropriate these days to talk about maintaining law and order, that phrase is not as meaningful as it was just a few short years ago on this or any other campus. In making and enforcing campus rules, institutions are now advised by legal authority that students do not surrender any of their First Amendment rights of freedom of religion, of speech, of press, privacy, and the right to peaceably assemble. And students cannot contract these rights away by signing some type of agreement at the time of admission acceptance. Yale President Dr. Brewster told a Stanford University audience that, quote, "society and its institutions must at some point have the right to banish those bent upon destruction," end quote. A kind of popular sort of statement to make these days. But you need to think about this a moment. The unanswered question that should be asked is, who determines what is meant by bent on destruction? The civil courts or an irate college president? An ancillary question could be, what is the extent or limitation of banishment? And who decides whether the student who advocates radical changes of the status quo deserves to be sent to Siberia for a lifetime or to Avila Beach for a day in the sun? Now, some solutions are pure nonsense, proposed by some wild-eyed utopian creators who advocate elimination of all structure in higher education, elimination of all rules and regulations, rejection of symbols of authority, especially administrators, and the development of a nirvana-like campus atmosphere. In such a utopia, kind-hearted teachers and pure-hearted students would lie upon the daisies and discourse in novel phrases of their complicated state of mind, in which the meaning doesn't matter if it's only idle chatter of a transcendental kind, with apologies to Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan fame. Some proposed solutions are more reasonable, at least from the point of view of faculty. For example, some outline academic freedom as seen by professors, and then attempt to show how this point of view could be extended in a limited way to students. But the involvement in decision-making would be limited, naturally, and would fit the criterion of relevancy only from the professor's view, not necessarily the student's view. Some proposed solutions by observers and participants who have gone through a sobering experience, like the several Berkeley demonstrations, suggest that college and universities officials, if they are wise, will carefully reinterpret a few regulations, thereby ensuring that students can have all the freedom they can use. Now, the rub to this solution is that the students won't feel they've achieved much additional freedom, and the public will claim that the administration is too permissive. To my way of thinking, the most simplistic sounding solution, but probably the most delicate and complicated one to initiate and implement, is stated simply this way. One, acknowledge as a fact of life that some rules of conduct for all members of the academic community, including students, faculty, and administrators are necessary. Two, then set about, by appropriate consultation, to define the application of these rules in the light of the objectives of that particular college. The objectives of this college never made it necessary that it try to play the role of the church. But because of a long history of housing and feeding students on campus, coupled with an evolutionary growth from a vocational secondary school to a degree-granting institution, it has for nearly a half a century struggled to fulfill the role of in loco parentis. This assumption of the responsibility for the total welfare of a student entrusted to the institution by his parents never was a workable arrangement and created most of the specific instances of confrontation between students and administration. The concept that an institution of higher learning is a substitute father-mother for students living away from home is being abandoned by most colleges, even private denominational institutions. In the absence of a fully developed new substitute doctrine for guiding relationships between student and institution, some educators have suggested that colleges should get out of the disciplinary field altogether, except for such academic offenses as cheating, plagiarism, and interfering with legitimate rights of others to use institutional facilities. I can't say that I would limit the list to just those three, but if you will look on page 52 in our 1968-69 catalog, you will see that we have only four basic causes for disciplinary action. But one of these, quote, disorderly, unethical, vicious, or immoral conduct, end quote, covers a multitude of sins, including the drinking or bringing of alcoholic beverages on campus, being intoxicated on campus, or using or having possession of illegal drugs. Our due process at Cal Poly for students accused of violations, where the punishment may be probation, suspension, or expulsion, is spelled out in the same catalog section. Last year, I requested Dean Chandler to develop a more specific due process procedure which would guarantee all the basic elements for a fair hearing. This he has done. But in addition, he offered the student body the opportunity to form a faculty student judiciary to hear all cases, act as an appellate board for the residence hall cases, etc. The present Cal Poly student judiciary limits its functions to interpretation of codes and bylaws of student government. While the student body has not yet accepted the offer to participate in the installation of effective faculty student judiciary for hearing of disciplinary cases, it is likely that the climate is right for such an innovation. During the decade 1950-1960, college professors frequently used the single word excellence to intimidate all but a few of their students. And so in the past 2 years, college and university students have reinforced one another's courage, and they've hurled back at the teaching profession their own rebel cry, relevance. And the statistics indicate that the students who are most disturbed, most anxious, most inclined to protest about the alleged irrelevance of the educational offerings are the majors in humanities and social sciences at both large multiversities and small liberal arts colleges. In fact, if it were not for the protests at the small liberal arts colleges, one might be misled into believing it was size alone that caused trouble at Berkeley and Columbia. In reacting to unrest and violence at college and university campuses, the Association of American Colleges has urged its 900 member institutions to make their offerings relevant. The statement acknowledged the fact that the collegiate institutions are not responsible for all the causes of unrest, but those institutions have an obligation to identify the underlying problems and to prepare students for the task of seeking solutions. The most effective curb to student unrest is to make the educational structure and its offerings responsive to the needs of contemporary society and contemporary students. The fact is, this solution is neither new nor guaranteed. For some years now, much earlier than the first of the current collegiate revolts, it has been recognized that specialized education, career preparation, was necessary to the continuation of the society which supports the educational institutions. Liberal arts education, on the other hand, was supposedly aimed at meeting the needs of the individual rather than society, at least in an immediate sense. Contemporary society needs engineers, scientists, mathematicians, industrial technologists, but liberal arts colleges are not going to change their spots and become technical institutions, and for a very good reason. They haven't the faculty or the facilities, and even if they could get both tomorrow, the young radicals would protest even more vehemently because that's not the kind of relevance they had in mind. One college president, in trying to find the solution to his students' charge of irrelevancy, proposed that we, quote, declare the formal general education movement dead and cease bowing to its corpse, end quote. He said students at his college speak of general education requirements like a childhood disease, something to get over but not enjoy. Interestingly, this same college president almost found one of the keys to the general education problem, but he missed it in the darkness of tradition. He recognized that the student already happily intent upon his specialty finds increased academic rigor a sort of early invitation to the Scholars Guild. But unfortunately, he concluded that for freshmen and sophomores uncommitted to a specialty, any increase in academic rigor is painful and threatening. It took another college president, James Perkins, president of Cornell University, to find the key, and he presented it at a meeting of the Association of American Colleges as an innovative idea which might solve the problem of relevancy. The fact that Cal Poly has been using this innovative new idea for 30 years or more should make us feel extremely relevant. Said President Perkins, and I quote, "The liberal arts and professional education for each student must go hand in hand throughout his academic career, just as it does in the last 2 years." He continued, "I do not find the concentration on general education for 1, 2, or 3 years a satisfactory solution, particularly for students who come to the university eager to move directly into professional fields of study. For these students, the liberal view may be even more useful toward the end of their education than at the beginning," end quote. Shades of upside down. One strong negative response to student demands for a hand in setting educational policy was voiced a year ago by Yale University President Brewster. And I quote, "Student demand to force the teaching of what seems relevant to the moment or to cater to the interests of the day can be a diversion. The university faculty has to be just as leery of catering to student demand to assuage purely topical interests as it does to catering to corporate or government pleas to solve an immediate business or official problem," end quote. I'm reminded, as I note this 20th century Yale president statement, of the viewpoint of a predecessor of his. In 1828, Yale president Jeremiah Day co-authored with Professor Kingsley of the Yale faculty the famous Yale report of that year. The report struck back at the then rising criticism that a college curriculum should include science and mathematics and other subjects more appropriate to the times than the traditional classical curriculum. Few Americans at that time were willing to undertake a debate with such an august body as the Yale faculty. And when the equally reactionary Princeton faculty joined Yale against any 19th century movement toward relevancy, they together set back by 25 years all efforts to meet the needs of society. It eventually became clear that denominational colleges were not prepared to meet the needs of society. Not until after the passage of the Land-Grant Act in 1862 did the state institutions realistically begin meeting the developing needs and new aspirations of the American people. And the Morrell Land-Grant Act was the most significant step toward relevancy ever taken in higher education. Now, I believe it is possible to create a dynamic balance within one institution, an equilibrium between what society needs and what the individual needs. Even though many people think that an institution with the word polytechnic in its title is technically lopsided in its offerings, it is not necessarily true. Students are attracted to this institution because they recognize the relevancy of each curriculum to one of the many diversified needs of society. When they look closely at the curriculum of their choice, they discover that many of the required courses and many that they may elect will be of value to them as individuals, as human beings, as future parents, as citizens, without regard to the careers they have selected. The core of general education courses, which each student takes, not in advance of his introduction to his major subjects, but concurrently, must at the same time be relevant to a changing society and to a bewildered individual. Making it so may be a more difficult task in balancing than providing courses in the major and supporting mathematics and sciences, which are up to date with the latest developments in the career for which the curriculum was devised. But we must not underestimate the difficulty of keeping our technical courses relevant to the latest needs of the fields with which they are associated. We have always prided ourselves on our ability to keep in touch with the latest developments. Hopefully, we have been sufficiently successful so that we pass the relevancy test today. But watch out for tomorrow and for the day after that. It's a never-ending struggle. And don't be envious of the faculty who believes they do not have to change. They are the ones who are the target for revolution. A speaker at a recent national education conference has described the problem of relevancy in these words. There has not been a period in recent decades when the personal motives of students and the personal motives of professors were wider apart. Although a research scholar himself, the speaker obviously had generalized to the point of creating stereotypes for both students and professors. I suspect that where this statement is not true is in institutions in which faculty members have time for their students, both undergraduate and graduate. If faculty members are under the evil pressure of the publish or perish dictum, they will have no time for youth, and their students will become alienated and cynical. At this college, I am confident that the concentration of our faculty on their role as teachers helps our students to concentrate on their role as learners. There is no gulf between teacher and learner. Many of you will recall that at last year's fall conference, a panel of speakers discussed the role of the faculty staff council in the governance of the college. Participating on that panel, I made reference to a publication entitled Statement on Government of College and Universities, which had been issued in January 1967 by the AUP, the ACE, and the Association of Governing Boards and Universities and Colleges. That publication, which had been 3 years in process, gave superficial treatment only to the role of students desiring to participate responsibly in the government of the institutions they attend. The three organizations sponsoring the publication concentrated on the appropriate advisory, recommending, and decision-making roles of faculty, administrators, and trustees, three of the constituent groups most traditionally involved in the government of colleges and universities. The report did not ignore the status of students, but it hedged on student participation with carefully drawn out conditional phrases and negative concepts. For example, and I quote, "The obstacles to CIS participation are large and should not be minimized. Inexperience, untested capacity, a transitory status, which means that present action does not carry with it subsequent responsibility, and the inescapable fact that the other components of the institution are in a position of judgment over the students." Despite these limitations, the report stated ways should be found to permit significant student participation within the limits of attainable effectiveness. Less than a decade ago, right here in California, some members of the then governing board of the state colleges, a majority of the then state college presidents, and a fairly sizable number of other state college administrators were as equally convinced that faculty members elected to faculty senates were unqualified to participate in policy formulation and for the same reasons as we now attach to student qualification for that role: inexperience, untested capacity, transitory status, and subordinate to the other components of the institution. Despite the negative aspects of the reference and the publication of the role of students in college and university governance, the spokesman for the three organizations acknowledged the legitimacy of the student role, but said the specific nature of that role must await further exploration before it can be worked into a formal definition. You can bet students have now written their own definition, and in some places they've punctuated it with violence. Although the 1967 statement sidestepped for the time being the knotty issue of how much and what kind of involvement students should have in college and university government, it did set forth one short paragraph in which were listed four opportunities colleges should give their students in order to enhance student respect for those colleges. One, to be listened to in the classroom without fear of institutional reprisal for the substance of their views. Two, freedom to discuss questions of institutional policy and operation. Three, the right to academic due process when charged with serious violation of institutional regulations. And four, the same right to hear speakers of their own choice as enjoyed by other components of the institution. At the beginning of the fall quarter last year, I announced details of the organizational structure and administrative policies which had been developed in consultation with many individuals and groups during the first 4 months that I was president. You will recall that I called for both faculty and student representatives to serve on such policymaking bodies as the President's Council, Foundation Board, Academic Council, Administrative Council, Campus Planning Committee. Furthermore, I encouraged other groups, including the Faculty Staff Council, to consider adding student representatives to faculty and administrative committees. My personal evaluation from watching a number of student representatives who served last year on councils and committees of which I am a member is that in every instance, their contribution was significant. They participated in discussions with faculty members, department heads, deans, and vice presidents without reticence, but with dignity, dedication, skill, and integrity. I believe that the students who served in these capacities last year will vouch for the fact that they had freedom to express their opinions, and these opinions were considered equally with those expressed by other members of each body. I honestly believe that their advice in many instances helped the administration to make decisions which maintained student morale at a high peak last year, with a minimum of conflict and just enough tension to keep us working together to build a stronger institution. As our present Faculty Staff Council reorganizes itself into the Faculty Senate and Staff Senate, in accordance with the results of the election held last spring, it might be well for those assigned responsibility for developing the new constitution and bylaws for these two policy recommending bodies to consider the following fact. There are 13 standing committees in the present Faculty Staff Council organization. On only one does there appear to be a provision for student representation. And yet at least half of those standing committees deal directly with matters of vital interest to students. We are becoming increasingly aware of the truthfulness of the 30-year-old theory of management which postulates a group's participation or lack of it in making decisions affects its willingness to accept the outcome. We hear much today from college administrators and faculty writers who advise the importance of including students on faculty and administrative committees so that the students will feel involved. Some have likened all of the disturbances, demonstrations, riots, sit-ins, strikes that have happened on a comparatively few college campuses as storm warnings, which should be heeded by colleges which have yet to be hit hard by student protests. The warnings always advocate strengthening student government so it can deal with the dissidents as a first line of defense. The warnings also describe how students should be added to certain faculty and administrative committees, particularly those that deal with rules and regulations regarding campus speakers, residence hall conduct, student discipline, and such obvious activities as athletics. When it comes to asking students to participate in policy decision making in the academic area, the attitude is most likely to be similar to that expressed by the assistant professor of history at Berkeley, and I quote, "The autonomy of the faculty in the areas of its own competence, and this includes the nature of the curriculum, the content of the courses, and the conduct of teaching and research, must be upheld against all incursions, whether they be from society at large, the governing board of the university, or the students. The university must be a free institution, but it cannot by its very nature be a democratic one. It is undemocratic in the sense that all elements within the university do not have equal prerogatives, and they do not by virtue of the differences in their training, their knowledge, and their roles," unquote. This being the case, where do we find democracy? Those people who liken the potential problems of student-initiated trouble at college campuses to a storm, for which the warnings are out and visible to those who are observant, are confusing us somewhat with a faulty analogy. So far, man has not been able to prevent a storm, only observe its path and run for cover. If some of the so-called preventatives that are advocated for colleges who have yet to experience real student violence are implemented only as tactical devices and not as sincere efforts to alleviate the underlying problems, then those who take that action will be doing the right thing for the wrong reasons. And I predict that when this is the motivation, it will be transparent and the action will fail to solve the problem. What I'm suggesting is simply that student involvement in the decision-making process will be effective only if we are sincerely interested in the effective assistance students can give in working on problems where they have some special interest and vital input. At a time when the actions of many students and faculty at other California state colleges are creating problems for the state college system with both the legislature and the public, Cal Poly's continued dedication to the serious business of education is not without its rewards. What conclusions have I tried to draw from all of this that is relevant to you and to me and to our students? In the simplest terms that I can muster, it is basically this. One, college students have a right to have available to them college offerings that are relevant to their personal needs and to the needs of our ever-changing society. Two, decisions as to what is relevant both to the individual and to society may well be best made by a wise and benevolent dictator, or by an intelligent oligarchy, or even by a third-generation computer properly programmed. But no matter how wise the decision, if the process used in obtaining and selecting alternatives has not included democratically selected representatives of the groups which will be affected by the decision, you can expect the real focus eventually will be on the process, even if the temporary frustration is aimed for strategy reasons at the quality of the decision. And finally, this being the case, we should establish processes for decision making which will be honest attempts to involve students as well as faculty and administrative staff appropriately in that process, not in a phony tactical attempt to co-opt students into the establishment. You cannot substitute a new hypocrisy for an old one and expect to survive. Thank you. Before we close, we have about a few minutes, and it is my privilege to be able to make some awards to some people you all know. The two gentlemen you see standing up here have served Cal Poly a total of 50 years, right? A little over that. Because actually had Bill Troutner, this is Bill Troutner, who was a member of the crops department, all those people back there have got to see you, Bill Troutner. This is Howard Brown, head of the ornamental horticulture department. And Bill would have gotten his award last year, but he was in Guatemala, an assignment for Cal Poly, an aid program we have there. And he's been there for 2 years with his wife and family, and they have just returned to, and I belatedly offer to Bill Troutner his 25-year service award, which reads, I have to read one of them, Howard. I can't read them both. They both say the same thing. In recognition of employment of the state of with the state of California for the period of 25 years, this certificate is presented to William R. Troutner for faithful public service, signed by, and this ought to go down in record. See, it's signed by Ronald Reagan and by Robert Kennedy. there's a pin to go with this. And wear that anytime you want girls to realize how old you are. Well, Bill came here in 1942, having graduated from Davis in 1938. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Don't go away. I have one for Howard. Howard has been at Cal Poly since 1943, having graduated from Ornamental Horticulture Department at that time, started his employment with us in 1943, served in the military service, has had some leaves for graduate study, but his service too accumulates to 25 years, and congratulations, Howard.
Thank you, President Kent.
Thank you. While Howard and Bill are going back to their seats, I'd like to have their wives, Beth Troutner. Would you stand, Beth? And Betty Brown, would you stand? You see, if it hadn't been for faithful wives, they never would have let them stay here that long. And now I'd like to have two more people come. Spellman Collins, would you come first? Spellman is retiring, so is Doug Miller. Spellman Collins and I joined the Cal Poly staff together in 1940. We were both in the freshman class. I think it's interesting to know that this institution came to its senses soon after our installation and abandoned a one-time tradition of putting new faculty members through an initiation procedure that was much like joining a fraternity, wasn't it? And I think that that maybe, I don't know how their Spellman protested, I protested afterwards so vehemently that I think that maybe helped end the tradition. Now, Spellman Doug, I can only read one at a time, but in accordance with guidelines established by the Faculty Staff Council, it's my privilege to confer upon you the title of Professor Emeritus and to declare to all members of the college's faculty and staff that you shall be granted all rights, benefits, and privileges established for this honorable status. The enclosed card lists several of these privileges and may be used by you to identify yourself as eligible to receive them. Your name will be included among Emeritus faculty in the next issue of the college catalog. Says the same thing on the one for Doug Miller. Doug came here. Congratulations. Doug came here a little later, April 20th, 1953. He has been publications manager and Public Relations Director during this time, since 1953, and he is retiring effective as of the end of this month. Is that right, Doug? And Doug and I have had a very close and personal relationship for many years, and I certainly hate to see him go. The reason he's retiring is he's in excess of the legal retirement age, and only for that reason, because mentally, physically, and every other way, this guy just ought not to retire. Thank you very much. And we have Mary Collins and Helen Miller in the front row. Would you like to stand up? Thank you. They say behind every successful man is two women. What's that story? Two women? His wife and a very surprised mother-in-law. Unless I read my program incorrectly, it's time for lunch. And there is a buffet luncheon to which the spouses are also welcome. Vice President Dale Andrews is presiding. It's being held in the student dining hall, not the staff dining hall. And it will be a buffet luncheon. You can go there and eat, and then you can hear about what is ASSIST. Thank you very much for coming.